Town School Finance, Agenda 5/23/85, 8 o'clock a.m., here in Room A. Work session on HB 2182, HB 2183, HB 2011. This is tape 235, side A.
Steve, where do we leave off?
If you can find your outline in your books, we should be behind the bill in the amendments for 2011.
Okay. No, it's here somewhere.
We finished with sections A and B yesterday, except for those parts that you wanted to come back to at a later time. So we're ready now to proceed with section C at the bottom of the front page of the outline.
Do you want to give us the sections and pages on the amendments if you're ready?
Number one under C is to update the child care credit. That is section 4 of the bill, page 2 of the bill. Right now, current state law gives a child care credit equal to 40% of the federal credit as it was in effect for 1979. And so this has caused a taxpayer to have to fill out a separate child care credit report for the state return than the federal return, because the feds have made changes to their child care credit provisions since 1979. The feds have increased the eligible child care expense from $2,000 to $2,400 for a single child, and from $4,000 to $4,800 for two or more children. So we would still be 40%, but we would be 40% of the federal credit as allowed for 1984 connect date, and this would reduce revenue by about $3.6 million for the biennium.
That's already been accounted for in the figures that we're looking at, right?
Yes.
Any questions? Recommend members? Okay, go ahead.
All right, number two on the second page of the outline deals with the elderly care credit update. Similar situation. This is in section 5 of the bill on page 3. Again, changing the date. The current state elderly care credit is 15% of the federal elderly care credit as of 1979. So again, the feds have made some changes. They doubled the income limit that's eligible for the credit from $2,500 to $5,000 for a single return, and from $3,750 to $7,500 for a joint return. So again, the state percent of the federal would remain at 15%, but it would be 15% of the federal credit as in effect for 1984 connect date.
Okay.
And this would decrease revenue about $400,000.
Representative Craighead?
Does that include then under, going back to item B7, where we included the permanent disabled, this would have been treated the same way with the 15% of the federal credit and so forth?
Yes. Okay. That the permanently or totally disabled would be eligible for 15% of the updated federal credit amount.
Further questions, comments? Okay, Steve.
Number three. There's no bill reference for that section that deals with the non-itemizer or charitable contribution deduction. The feds have that provision in their statutes now. It was also in the federal statutes for 1982 and was phased up over time. The 1983 legislature decided to not reconnect to that particular item in 1983 for tax years '83 and '84. So for 1985, there will be a separate separate charitable deduction for those who do not itemize their deduction. So the taxpayer that takes a standard deduction will be allowed a charitable contribution. For 1985, the federal limit is 50% of the contribution with no maximum amount. And then 1986, it's the full amount of the charitable contribution, no percentage limit or dollar limit. And then under current federal law, it would sunset in 1987.
Steve, we're going to have to come back to this when the full committee is here. Perhaps
it is on the discussion list.
Why don't you take a minute and go ahead and put those numbers on the board.
Those limits?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And Steve, this also has something like $15 million impact, is that right?
It would be an additional, yes, $15 million by not allowing it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
It's on the list.
It's on the list.
Right.
Yeah.
So, we need.
Mr. Chair. Representative Bailey. If I understood Steve correctly, this particular item is not in the present draft. Is that correct?
So it's not in the draft in the sense that we would be reconnecting, if I understand it correctly. Right, Steve?
Right. The 83 provision disconnect on this sunsets, okay. So that we will have the non-itemizer charitable contribution provision unless something else is.
Oh. So it goes into place if we don't take action.
Right.
We have to take action to keep it from happening.
Yeah, we have to take action.
Yeah. Or do nothing and it goes in.
Mm.
But just try. Mm.
And it started out being a fairly small amount. The total dollar amount being $100, and then the maximum percent being 25% of that, or a maximum $25 deduction. The charitable contribution phases up to total $25 for 84. And then no dollar limits in 85 and 86, but still having a percentage limit in 85 and basically no percentage limit in 86, the full amount. And I think 82 may have been in there too.
The charitable contribution for non-itemized.
Okay, questions or discussion? We'll have to come back to this when the full committee is here. This is a $15 million item that's on our list of possible considerations. Okay, Steve, skip to the next one.
Okay, number four on the outline deals with section 3A of the bill. On page 2 of the bill, it would allow the use, or would require the use of federal AGI, adjusted gross income, when calculating any limits that are defined as a percent of AGI. So that if you are calculating your Oregon standard deduction, for example, part of that deduction is limited to 13% of adjusted gross income. So it would be calculated as 13% of your federal adjusted gross income, without any changes for Oregon purposes. There is no definition of Oregon adjusted gross income in the statutes. For years like 1985, when we have just reconnected, federal AGI and Oregon AGI would be the same, but for the second year of the biennium, when the feds have perhaps made some changes that require changes on the Oregon side to negate that, then what would be considered Oregon AGI could differ from federal AGI. And so this would just require those percentages to be as a percent of federal AGI as the taxpayer has used on his federal return in calculating any medical limitations, casualty loss, charitable contribution limits, and then on the state side, the standard deduction.
Questions? Comments?
So, well, then let me just add, for some taxpayers, that might be a slight advantage, and for some, a slight disadvantage on what the deduction amount would be.
Okay, go ahead.
Number five deals with sections eight and nine of the bill. Page four of the bill. And this deals with the filing status for resident, non-resident, or resident, part-year resident spouses. And this then would require that they file separately unless they elect to file a joint return as full-year residents. Part of this relates back to the change in the law now that was made for dealing with non-residents, primarily, again, going back to the bill that you passed, dealing with how Washington residents that are full-year non-residents are taxed by Oregon, so that only the Oregon part of their income is included. So that this has caused some problems in how to treat a combination resident, non-resident situation. And so to try to follow the procedure where only Oregon income is included for the non-resident spouse, then the department felt that this was the best way to handle that situation. The department may want to make more comments on that.
Would you come up and go over this with us, please?
That's right, where are we now?
Sections eight and nine, item number...
Five.
Five.
C5.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Verlina Cross with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Basically, the department does suggest this way of handling it, primarily because we worked with our attorneys to determine what would be a constitutional way to do it. And we have currently been challenged by Washington residents for having a separate filing status when you have a four-year resident and then a part-year resident, or a four-year resident and a non-resident. In that situation, the Oregon law currently allows them to file separately. It does not, however, allow, for example, if you have a part-year resident married to a non-resident, etc. So what this does is expand that exception about any time you have at least one of whom is not an Oregon resident, they could file a separate return, and that cannot be constitutionally challenged, is what our attorney said. So that's basically why we came in with that amendment.
Questions? Okay, go ahead. Why don't you just stay there, Belinda? Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
George, do you have a question?
Yeah, I don't know what to, I don't know how to ask it.
Go ahead.
I still got confused. I'm not sure I understand exactly what you're trying to get at.
Okay. Currently in the law, if I, for example, I'm a four-year resident, and if I marry somebody that was living in, let's say, California for half the year, and then they move to Oregon, they are part-year resident. The law would say, in that type of situation, the current law says, in that type of situation, we can elect to file jointly, or we could file separate, even though on a federal return we would file joint. Generally, whatever you use as your filing status for federal purposes, you have to use, you know, for Oregon. The current law allows an exception. It does not, however, allow it in any other case where you have both of them non-residents or both part-year residents or any of those other categories, just where you have one full-year resident and then something else. What this would do is expand that exception to include situations that do exist and cannot be constitutionally challenged. We are currently being constitutionally challenged because we had, for example, two non-residents in Washington, and one of them works in Oregon and one of them doesn't. Okay, in that situation, they are not allowed currently to file a separate return. Under this, they would be. And that negates the constitutional challenge.
Got there. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions, comments? Okay, Steve.
Number six, let me insert a five and a half here.
Five and a half.
Kind of separate the issues. Section three of the bill on page two deals with pension plans. And basically, right now, Oregon follows federal law on pension plans and the amount of contribution allowed to those pension plans, the $2,000 for an IRA, for example. This section would say that if the feds change the contribution amount, that that would not disqualify the plan for Oregon purposes, even though Oregon might not accept or at least initially recognize the higher contribution amount on the federal side, for example. Right, so that's section three, and then the amendment proposed by the Department of Revenue, a new amendment that should be behind your outline in the bill, will make, take those same provisions and insert a new section 44A for the corporate side. Section three in the bill just deals with the personal side. And then the other portion, other side of this is in section 12 on page 7 in the bill, where if there is excess contributions on the federal side, then the interest earned on those contributions would not be taxed for Oregon purposes until distributed.
Questions? Go ahead.
Okay. Number seven is section 23 of the bill on page 13. Dealing with regulated investment companies, which are commonly referred to as mutual funds. And again, we have a situation here where the feds do not tax some interest that the state does, and clarify this for me if necessary, but we are allowing these mutual funds then to go ahead and deduct that interest that they distribute as dividends on the Oregon side as well, just like they would on the federal side if all of that interest was subject to the federal provisions. Gary can explain that better, I think.
Okay, Gary.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Mulgar, and I'm a corporation owner with the Department of Revenue. I really didn't come to add anything, Steve. I was here to answer questions if they come out. I agree with your explanation.
Mr. Chair. Gary, the outline talks about Oregon bond interest. Now, are we talking about Oregon interest earned off of Oregon bonds, or are we talking about other than Oregon municipals?
Representative Traeger, it would be more than just Oregon bond interest. It would be Oregon or state and municipal bond interest. All of this interest is non-taxable at the federal level, and that's the reason that the federal government does not provide a subtraction when these are distributed out to the shareholders. What we're saying is, since it is taxable for Oregon corporate purposes, to follow the concept that federal has set up on these regulated investment companies, we are proposing to allow that as a subtraction to the extent it's distributed. I might add that we have, under prior law, we specifically said that a regulated investment company or taxable income for Oregon was the same as federal.
Right.
When we reconnected, or when, excuse me, when we connected to federal law in 83, we inadvertently did not put a provision here. We didn't realize that some of the modifications that we have in our law would affect these regulated investment companies. So although we may start at zero taxable income, and we usually do for federal purposes, if there's a modification for bond interest, that would create a positive taxable income. So we have by rule at the present time prescribed this treatment to allow a subtraction to the extent that that income is distributed, but I guess we're looking for some clarification or support for that rule as to legislative intent.
Would the effect of this be that through one of these mutual funds, an individual could, in effect, maybe hold is a bad word, but receive the income off of out-of-state municipal bonds as a tax-free distribution? Is the tax going to get paid out someplace?
If there are, I believe, and I'm not an expert on the personal law, but I believe that if it is bond interest from another state, it would be taxed.
That's right. And my question is, through this, is there any way to escape that? Are we leaving a loophole that we don't leave the individual that holds that other than Oregon municipal and has to pay tax on it?
No, I think what Representative Trojan, I think what we're doing is we're treating it more or less as if the interest was received by the individual directly, which is really the whole concept of this regulated investment company. It's a flow-through type entity where the treatment of the income is essentially treated the same way it would be if it were received directly by the individual. You know, whether or not it is taxable, like I say, if it is Oregon bond interest, I believe that it would not be taxable to the individual anyway.
That's correct.
But if it were California bond interest, I believe it would be.
Is that right?
My question, everybody's passed on,
I'm getting
that shows on the tape or not, but I want to be sure that whether these bonds are held through one of these or whether they're held individually, that they're treated the same is what I was trying to get at, and I think that's what they're telling me they're doing with this.
Any other comments by any of you, Don or Jim?
Well, just a little clarification. Basically what this provision is trying to do is avoid double taxation of those flowing through so they don't get taxed for the corporate and then also to the individual.
But they do get taxed once in the process.
Right, but not twice.
Okay, any questions or comments? Go ahead.
Number 8 is in sections 18 and 19 of the bill on pages 9 and 10. It would make the Oregon net operating loss again the same as federal to Oregon modifications in determining what that Oregon net operating loss is. And then there's a section that would, when there is a net operating loss and refund, clarifying when the interest would start. And my understanding is that this is primarily for simplification in this calculation for the taxpayer.
The department may be able to tell you what's involved now in terms of having to calculate that on a separate form.
Okay, Berlina, why don't you do that?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, what happens in Oregon net operating losses, and this is only for personal income tax, this is not for corporation income tax that we're dealing with in item number 8, but there was a Bechtel case which basically said you had to make certain modifications which sometimes increase and sometimes decrease your federal net operating loss. Because of the disconnects and reconnect that we have been doing over the last few years, the net operating loss has become substantially harder and harder to compute for Oregon purposes. You don't just start out with your federal loss, you have to make these manipulations to it. And we have in the last, say, year and a half, we've had to put on special workshops for CPAs and LPCs to show them how you use the forms and how the information flows through to the return. So basically, in some situations, the taxpayer would have a larger net operating loss And in some instances, they will have a smaller net operating loss for Oregon purposes. It was basically for simplicity that we were putting this amendment in.
Okay, questions? For the comments? Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, number nine is in section 28A of the amendments, page 14 of the amendments. This deals with the situation where some corporations are set up purposely to hold property for exempt organizations, and they're usually called title holding corporations. The specific example that I was given for this situation is where a pension trust fund owns property as an investment of the pension fund, and then a separate corporation is set up by the pension fund to hold the title to the property, to manage it, and then all of the income earned after expenses of the corporation is turned over to the exempt organization. So that it's a means of using the title holding corporation to protect the pension trust fund from any liability passing beyond the corporation holding the property. And so this provision here would, in those cases where those title holding corporations are in effect for an exempt organization, would clarify that their income is exempt from tax, because if the property was held by the exempt organization, it would be exempt from tax to begin with.
Questions? We spent considerable time in the subcommittee discussing this. This was all right.
Sure. This was brought as a request of Hardy Myers, attorney representing evidently a couple of these holding companies.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Craig.
You spent a lot of time on it in the subcommittee. Did you identify any loopholes or any way that this could be manipulated?
I asked most of the questions about it. If you had a charitable or non-profit organization such as a hospital, which I've always found to be fascinating devices anyway, then you had operating it on behalf of the charitable non-profit organization, would this company be exempt from income earned? And the answer is yes, to the extent that income is given back to the non-profit corporation. If the company earns a management fee or some other fee for doing that service, that income would be exempt. But the income that's passed on through would be exempt, as if it were the nonprofit or charitable corporation. I think the most common example we were given was where a charitable organization owns a building, and that building is then leased or rented to other people. The leasing agent may be a separate corporation doing all that. That portion of the income going back to the charitable organization would be exempt. Portion of the income retained for the fee for serving or doing that would not be exempt.
We took a lot of shots at it. We couldn't find anything really wrong. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, then in moving on into section D.
There's something in there, we just couldn't find it.
It's gotta be there.
Let me say too here that there are some federal provisions governing the title holding companies as well. Number one under section D deals with section 12 of the bill on page 8. It's just a simple reference change for the definition of interest qualifying for our interest exclusion. There was a number change in the IRC code, and this corrects that, brings it up to date.
Questions, comments?
Number two deals with section 14 of the bill on page 8. Again, clarification language there so that it spells out various situations that cause a difference in the basis of an asset, And then it clarifies that those differences have to be dealt with when the asset is sold to reflect the different treatment for state versus federal.
Jim, why don't you take a shot at explaining that? Also, not that Steve didn't do a good job, but it's
for the complicated. Mr. Chair, Jimmy Gaffney with the CPA firm of Arthur Anderson and member of the board for the Oregon Society of CPAs. I agree with the statement that this is a clarification of something that already exists from the conformity efforts in prior years. And the concern is that if you have, for example, a different method of depreciation, that means that your basis, your net basis for purposes of computing gain or loss is going to be different for state purposes than for federal purposes. And this simply recognizes the fact and tries to enumerate the identified situations, and I agree with the situations that are enumerated, that you may end up with a different basis. And the point is that, say for example, for Oregon, that someone is recovering their costs over a slower method because of the difference in appreciation methods, they'll then have a higher basis for purposes of computing gain, which says that overall, they're going to recover all of the costs that they've put into that asset. It's just going to be a different timetable than it is for federal purposes. I think it's